Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. My name is Sarah, and I'm so pleased to be here today with the wonderful and amazing Jacqueline Moriarty.
Thank you so much.
Jacqueline's book, A Tangle of Gold, which is the concluding book in the amazing trilogy, The Colours of Madeline, is just about to be launched out into the world, and that's what we're here today to talk about. So we're going to keep things light on spoilers for people who haven't read the third book, and for people who haven't read this trilogy at all. I can't recommend it enough. But just to kick things off, can you tell us a bit about The Colours of Madeline and what's it about?
Sure. The Colours of Madeline trilogy is set partly in the real world in Cambridge, England, and partly in an imaginary kingdom called the Kingdom of Cello. And it's about a girl called Madeline who lives in Cambridge, who starts writing letters to a boy named Elliot, who lives in the farming district of the Kingdom of Cello, and they write letters through a crack that opens up between worlds that is in a parking meter.
Now, what I love about this story is that you have the real world and you have the Kingdom of Cello, but, you know, it's not that easy. It's not like walking through a closet in Narnia. It's not like you can just pop in and out. It's really like there's a lot of science and a lot of difficulty between traveling between these two worlds. Could you go explain a bit about the challenges of that? Because
sure, that's a good question, because that was interesting to me. That's partly what I wanted to do, to look into that issue of a world being right there, it's right next door, but it's almost impossible to reach. So I liked the idea of them being the two characters. In the first book, they never actually meet each other. They write letters. Oh, is that a spoiler? No.
I think we can say what doesn't happen.
I can say, yeah, okay.
That's all right.
They never actually meet each other. They're writing letters to each other. And for the first book, Madeline doesn't even really believe that the kingdom exists. For a lot of the first book, she thinks it's somebody else's fantasy or somebody's playing a trick on her. And in the second book, she believes in the Kingdom of Cello, and I wanted the second book to be about the idea of trying to shake reality, trying to figure out how we get through to the other world. And the third book is about finding a way through and what happens when the two worlds intersect. But to me, the idea of them being so very close that they can actually speak to each other at the same time and almost feel as if they're standing next to each other, but also worlds apart, that was what was intriguing to me. I wanted it to be somehow a convincing scientific reason for them to be another universe there. So I did a lot of reading on physics and the possibility of alternate universes and dimensions. So I wanted it to feel plausible. I wanted to convince myself that there could be a world there and then try to figure out how scientifically we might get through.
Well, and the beauty of it for me is that cello is, as far as fantasy worlds go, it's so wonderfully, whimsically out there. Like, you've got lakes of spells, you've got colour storms, you've got people who can fly. It's really like, as far as readers are concerned, you are stretching the imagination like really far. But because it's in this framework of, you know, there's scientific backup for this in the world, you've fought so hard to, you know, believe in this world, and you've seen the characters slowly come to believe in this world, that it just is completely credible. And that to me is, you know, so amazing. It's one thing to convince people that an alternate reality exists where there's no colour orange, but to go as far as to convince people that this world could happen, I mean,
oh, good.
I can't imagine the work that must have taken. But and it reminded me a bit, I wanted to ask you a bit about your influences, because just in that one aspect of the all of the science and research that went into it sort of reminded me a bit of His Dark Materials. But it's such a different kind of story to that. But with sort of, are you a fan?
I love Philip Pullman. I read those books, and they were definitely an influence, especially the idea. I think in the final book of that trilogy, I can't remember. I can't give spoilers about that either. But
I think I know what you're referring to. That the whole thing hinges on a relationship.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that to me was so overwhelming and powerful, the idea of there are worlds and you cannot, and there's a point at which you can't get through, we are never going to be able to see each other again. So that stayed in my mind for a long time, so that was definitely an influence. And the Narnia books were a big part of my childhood.
Yeah.
And I love the Bartimaeus trilogy as well.
I don't know.
I don't know, Jonathan Stroud.
I know all of it. I haven't read it.
Okay, that sort of convincing. I love fantasy that is convincing and that has a kind of framework, like you say, a scientific framework, because I want to believe in it. And Diana Wynne-Jones, I started reading after I had written the first book, because somebody told me this reminds me of Diana Wynne-Jones.
It definitely did with me.
And then I completely fell in love with her, and I've just been obsessed with reading her books ever since then.
I love Diana Wynne-Jones.
Good.
And especially like Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah.
And Princess Co in your stories had flashes of Howl to me, like just this larger-than-life character who, again, trying to tread carefully with spoilers, but has a persona that they assume to kind of make themselves appear less threatening than what maybe they are.
Oh, good.
But also just wrapped up in absurdity. And I just love it. The humour in this book is just, it's almost like the closest example I can think of is like the quirkiness that you find in Diana Wynne-Jones. But like, it's almost unlike any humour I've come across before. You're like, the sparkling, light-hearted sense of humour that you have in these books and also in your Ashbury Brookville books is like just such a delight to read. So I wanted to ask you, you know, are there humorous authors or comedians that you really like? Or
that's very kind of you. I just wanted to say thank you so much for saying that. That's really kind. That makes me happy. So now I can't think of an answer. I'm just feeling happy that you found it funny, because I think I have a bit of a strange sense of humour. So where would that have come from? And somebody was asking me about that the other day, whether your sense of humour was developed by your family, and that made me think about, I suppose everybody's sense of humour is developed by the things around them, the humour they're confronted with, they're exposed to, the books they read and the movies and shows and things like that, but also in a big way it must be the people you spend most time with.
Yeah.
And I come from a family of 6 kids, and everybody does laugh a lot. And I guess most families do a lot of laughing. Well, I hope families do a lot of laughing, but there is a focus on, we're trying to make each other laugh in this family. So when we get together, that's what we're trying to do. And I was thinking, when someone asked me about this, was it your family? I was thinking about the different kind of sense of humour that everybody in my family has and how that together could construct your sense of humour. So my dad's sense of humour is to be completely wild. He just says the most, he's always says things like, you never spoil a good story with the facts. So he was that kind of, he invented things all the time. And when you're a kid and you're not sure whether, and your dad speaks in a voice of authority and he's making up a crazy story and you're not sure, is this real or is this pretend? So there's that aspect of it. And my mum was more the straight man, she's quite sensible and straightforward, but every now and then she has this edge which comes out of nowhere where she says something where you think, oh, mum just made a joke, and it was quite sharp and unexpected. So I think that in combination, and also that my dad, he's very funny, but he's also very careful not to, it's difficult to explain, he doesn't laugh unless he genuinely finds something funny. So you have to work hard to make him laugh. So that became an issue, that was a challenge in our family. So maybe that helped too. And my sister Leanne, who comes first in the family, I'm come second, and Leanne is an author also, and our younger sister Nicola is also an author. Leanne laughs a lot, so I was thinking it's a contrast between trying to make Dad laugh and that you have to work. But Leanne laughs easily, and she has this big, wonderful laugh. So you want to keep up whatever you're doing, you want to keep it up. So that was a long, convoluted answer, sorry, to your question. But only because I've been thinking about that, I wonder how a sense of humour gets made.
Sounds like your family gatherings would be a lot of fun, though.
Now for us, for outsiders, maybe just confusing and chaotic, but we find it funny.
Well, another thing that really strikes me on top of the amazing imagery and humour in these books, is that they are so well plotted, and in a lot of ways, there's a lot going on, but in a lot of ways they're a mystery, kind of, because you're always trying to, each book has slightly different things that you're trying to figure out, but I think, you know, it's not a spoiler to say the first book is very much wrapped up in Elliot's father and what happened to him. And so within this construct of a mystery, you manage to pull out so many shock twists and little reveals that I don't know if it's that I'm enjoying it so much that I'm not looking for them, but they catch me by surprise every time. So, and because so much of that groundwork is laid right at the beginning for the reveals that happened in the third book, I just have to ask, did you plan out the whole trilogy before you started writing? What was your process there?
I did. I wanted to, at first it was going to be a 5-book series, actually. That was my first idea. I just remembered that right then. So I planned 5 books, and then somebody suggested that a trilogy might be a better idea, and I was very glad they did, because the complications of the plot would have become a bit overwhelming over 5 books, I think. Mm-hmm. But so then I started again, and I spent, because I had spent a few years thinking about the Kingdom of Cello as a place, and then even and then a year or so thinking about Madeline and Elliot, trying to get to know them in my head. And then I think I spent another year planning the 3 books. So I have about 200 pages of notes, so with lots of diagrams. And for me, and I think partly the complexities come from, because I love planning, I love that stage, and because it's a time when anything is possible, it just feels like this is going to be a masterpiece, because I haven't written a word, so it could be anything. Who knows what it's going to be? And then, so then I get stuck, trapped in this planning phase where the more I want it to be great, the more frightened I am of starting it and finding out it's not great. And so I just every day go back and say, what else could happen? What else could happen? And keep writing, and I use great big giant notepads and coloured textures to draw pictures, and mm-hmm. I start reading books. I started researching things that are completely unrelated to the book in a way seems to stimulate my imagination. So that gave me new ideas too. Things that were, so reading about the science would give me an idea about the plot or the character. So yes, I did way too much planning, and then it was a huge jump to, and so a lot of it didn't end up in the book, but at least I knew from the beginning what was going to happen in the last book.
So when characters are introduced in book one, and again, maybe we should have a signal. If I get close to saying something spoilery, just, you know, tap your nose or something. But like when certain characters show up in book one, you know what they will reveal about themselves in book 3.
I do. I do, although I was going to say, I was just thinking, I kept saying proudly when I was writing the first book, I know exactly what's going to happen in the third book, because I had these 200 pages of notes. But when I did get to the third book and looked over my plan for that, I did find a lot of places where I had put things in square brackets where figure out something amazing to happen here. And then I was really annoyed with my former self, because I had convinced, I thought, I know everything's going to happen. And then our next 2 pages on, exactly, pull it all together somehow, and just, you know, or in big, colourful print, and then an amazing climax. What are you talking about? So, but basically overall, between the second and third book, I did stop and have to do quite a lot more planning, but it's to the major overarching plot points were there from
totally
the start.
Totally planned.
Yeah.
And we've discussed a bit of the scientific research, but you also have a lot of historical figures playing a role in the book. Are you into history? Did you already know a lot of this about characters like Byron and Isaac Newton, or did you learn it all when you were writing the book?
This, I think I knew. I'd studied English literature, so I knew a bit about Byron. And I also studied history, and I love history, but that was years and years ago. So it was wonderful to be reading history again, and it was never necessary to my idea to begin with. It was just a book about the Kingdom of Cello in Cambridge. It was just because I decided that colours had come to life. I decided that that didn't happen straight away, but in the Kingdom of Cello, you know, the colours are the monsters, and the colours have taken on, have manifested themselves into different forms. When I decided that that was going to happen, then I wanted to read about the science of colours. And when I started reading the science of colours, I found that the story of Isaac Newton having discovered that white light can be split into the spectrum, into the visible colours of the electromagnetic spectrum. And there was just such a lovely story about him going, living in Cambridge, and going to the market and buying the spectrum, and then going home to his little room and putting dark curtains on the windows and having a tiny hole of light. And then the way he tells the story of the wonder of seeing these colours, the white light separating, and realising what that meant. And the fact that that was such a charming story, and the fact that I hadn't realised that Newton spent all his life at Cambridge, and I had already decided to set the book in Cambridge, and that coincidence made me think, I'm going to read more about Isaac Newton and make him important to the trilogy. And then Madeline can be doing an assignment for school on Isaac Newton. And then I thought, well, if Madeline's doing a project on somebody, then her friends who are studying with her have to also be doing projects on people. Yeah. So all of this is the kind of procrastination that comes before you start, you know, just, okay, I better follow up this path now, even though it's completely irrelevant. So I decided to look up what other famous people were at Cambridge. And that's when I found who in particular studied at Trinity College, Cambridge, which is where they are doing their homeschooling. And that's when I found about Byron and Charles Babbage, the mathematician, and
Ada Lovelace.
They had such great stories.
Yeah, and they're woven so cleverly into your story.
Well, thank you.
Because, yeah, every time you think these, like, notes of clarity where everything ties together have come, and you're like, well, that's why we've been learning so much about Isaac Newton, then you realise, no, there's more. There's going to be another moment where you're like, oh.
Good.
Well, it's full of aha moments.
Good, because Isaac Newton's such a great character, isn't he?
I did not realise any of this until I read your book. I mean, I think I knew that an apple fell on his head and gravity, that's it. That
exactly.
was my Isaac Newton knowledge. Possibly a little bit confused with things that I knew about Ben Franklin. So I feel like I've got a way better grasp of what he was all about, and also now tinged with a lovely, fanciful possibilities.
Good, I'm glad.
There's so much here to talk about. There's so many recurring themes, and it all just ties so wonderfully together. You constantly getting this feeling like it's a kaleidoscope clicking into place again and again. And I just wanted to talk about some of those themes, because some really struck me. They have one, and I can't actually remember, I think it's in book two, a moment where you're talking about everything having two sides and everyone having two sides, but having this infinite space in between those two sides. And I just thought that was a really interesting idea, that it's true of your characters as well as these alternate realities that they're in. Or, I mean, it's all one reality, but these two sides of reality.
Okay.
I'm blabbing.
Yeah. No, you're not. It's good. I'm glad you noticed that, because I became more and more fascinated by that idea as I was reading, probably just from the idea that there's two worlds adjoining, and that, in a sense, Kingdom of Cello represents the magical, and our world is the rational and the scientific and the real. And then the science of, I'm going to forget this dual, I'm going to forget the scientific terminology, the wave-particle duality, I think I bring that into the second book. And then when I started writing the third book, I read a new article about recent discovery saying there is no longer wave-particle duality. I said, no, I already put that in the second book. But that was around for a long time. So lots of different aspects of duality just became more and more interesting to me. And the fact that that we are all, in a sense, magical and scientific both at once, and that especially reading about Isaac Newton and the 17th century, which was a time when science was becoming the predominant force, and there was still so much superstition and magic in the world then, and it was just being gradually faded out, and thinking about how we have crushed that aspect of ourselves, and we diminish the importance of imagination and creativity and possibility because we're so focused on the rational and just thinking, well, let's let some of that back in.
Yeah, and with colour and light.
Exactly, yeah.
I also really liked how you play in this whole series with identity and how your knowledge of yourself is shaped by memory, and without those memories, you know, who you are and how you can understand yourself. And just the horror that comes along with having all of your memories taken away. Mm-hmm. Like it was really quite scary to see, I don't know, this might be a tapping nose moment, but like to see unnamed characters go through this experience of reshaping their whole identity but knowing that something is missing
mm-hmm.
from their true selves.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense.
It does make sense, and it's something that I didn't, because amnesia in a sense was a plot device to begin with, but then when I started writing about it and thinking about it, it became confronting to me, trying to ask yourself exactly what that would be like to put yourself together again. And because missing people, the idea of a missing person was a big part of the book, because in the first book both Madeline and Elliot have missing fathers, missing in different ways, but they are experiencing what it's like to have this absence in their life, and then thinking about different ways in which you can be missing and different forms of absence, and that would be one, not knowing who you are and not knowing, or any kind of illness that causes a memory loss, Alzheimer's, and how people have compared having Alzheimer's to being like a missing person, and
yeah,
so thinking of any form of amnesia and how confronting that would be. And because there are young adult books, so identity is always important in young adult books, because when you're a teenager, that's when you are finding out who you are in a sense.
Yeah.
So if you add amnesia to that, I felt like it added an extra interesting layer.
Yeah, and allows for a lot of twisty turns in the plot.
Good, I hope so.
So I have to ask this. Will we have more cello books ever, are you going to go back to that kingdom?
I like the idea of going back to it, because there were so many pages of notes, and because as I was working on it, so for example the colours, because the colours come to life in the kingdom of cello, so I drew up a big table with different shades and all the forms of different shades of colours and the form that each took and the effect that it had. So some of them are violent and some of them are gentle and beautiful.
I was wondering if you had to keep a dictionary.
So yeah, like a dictionary of colours. So because I did this big table of colours, there were lots of colours that never ended up being used in the trilogy because I ran out of space for them. So I like the idea of going back and using those, and just because I know so much about them. But I'm working on completely different things for the next couple of years, I think. So it'll be a while before I go back.
Okay. Are you allowed to tell us anything about what you're working on? Or?
Sure, I can. Yeah, I think I can. Because I'm working on a few different things at once. I usually am working on a few different things at the beginning, and then I settle on one book and stick with that for a while. But I've been working on four different books and just still working on four different books for the last year, I think. And one is about a girl whose parents have run away to have adventures with pirates. When she was a baby, they left her with her aunt, and now that she's 10, she's got a message saying you have to deliver this treasure chest full of treasure to 10 other aunts. So she's going on a journey. So that's maybe slightly younger, the young adult, maybe 12-year-old. And then I'm writing an adult book, which is about a woman who signs up for a series of seminars which promise to teach her the secret to human flight. They want to teach her how to fly.
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of a little bit to do with the self-help industry, how, you know, the self-help industry will promise you anything if you put your mind to it.
Yeah.
So this one is teaching her, yes, yes, you can fly. So, and another young adult book I'm working on, which my other earlier books were the Ashbery Brookfield books. So I've just started a new Ashbery Brookfield book going
back to those
high schools. So, yes, and another adult book about time travel. There's too much going on. Oh, good. Thank you.
I love those books.
Good.
They're great. And which brings me to another question I want to ask you, because a recurring thing in that series and in The Colours of Madeline is telling stories through letters, which I have to say is not usually my favourite. Like, normally there's like two exceptions to this I can think of, and one is your writing and the other is Illuminae, which came out this year, which I just loved, and it had that same storytelling, the epistolary, epistolary.
Yeah, that's a hard one to say, isn't it? I'm not going to try.
But yeah, telling the story through letters or just finding different documents to tell the story through. And I just, it just works so well. Like, what is it about that style that attracts you? Because you've used it often and so well.
I do. I keep thinking this book, I will keep letters out of it. I keep thinking, this is ridiculous. Stop using all these letters.
No.
And I start doing a narrative and then letters start coming into it. I can't seem to stay away from them. But I think it came from, I had a friend when I was in high school who, well, that's two things. I think I had a friend who, when I was in high school, she moved to another school when we were about 15, and we decided to keep in touch by writing letters to each other, even though she was still living quite close. We just decided we will write letters to each other. And then from the age of 15 to 22, we wrote letters every other week. And she is an artist, so she used to decorate, send me little pictures and decorate the envelopes with pictures. And she was a very funny letter writer, she still is. And so it became a big part of my high school years and teenage years that we became really close through that. We'd just been kind of friends before, but then we became like best friends through telling each other secrets. So there was something about this, because we were both quite shy, but we could open up in the letters. And also, and that's another way of developing a sense of humor, I guess. She was so funny that I wanted to make her laugh in my letters too. And we learned to type, we started typing letters, so that's how I learned to type. And being able to confide in somebody and tell when you felt sad or happy about something. And so it was a very important part of my life. So letters became important to me. But the other thing is, because I was a lawyer for a few years, and something about, and in litigation and trying to find evidence through documents was quite fascinating to me, the way you would have a pile of documents and there would be something like a pile of legal documents, a contract and a deed and a formal letter, and then you would find a letter that was handwritten from an old lady who was living, whose life was being affected in some way by this major legal dispute, and she would write in her beautiful handwriting to say, I don't think you realize what you are doing to me, something like that. And how just a short letter like that in the midst of legal documents which were already telling a story, and how a letter from an individual changes the course of the story in a way and can be so powerful. And so that, I think, being a lawyer and seeing how stories fit together through different fragments and cases we did which were to do with that. There was a case we did, I worked on, which had to do with a Sydney high school, and which meant we had boxes of documents which were school records of different students and records relating to teachers, and just glimpses you get. So I just find it so powerful how you get a glimpse of a whole story based on a short document, like at somebody's report card or just a piece of a sick leave request and just two lines, and you put them all together and they together, the fragments make a story. And there's something about a lot of the story is in the spaces between the documents.
No, that's exactly right. I think there's something about the way that you use letter writing that it's the things that aren't explicitly said that strike you the most. And it just cuts right to the heart of character, because it's just like a long string of dialogue, really, and like thoughts. And I just feel like I particularly, of all of the books in the Colours of Madeline series, this one's probably the lightest. Tangled World might be the lightest on letters, But the letters that are there are just so great. Like, I loved the ones between Jupiter and Madeline. Like,
okay.
I really loved those. And also, you know, the sort of curt letters that Kira was sending through, and they're like little, like, every time they show up, they just give you a greater understanding. And that's coming from me, someone who doesn't normally like, but like, I don't normally, if I pick up a book, and unless it has a Jacqueline Murray Addy or now J. Christoph and Amy Kaufman on the front, I would be like, letters, oh no.
Yeah, I'm the same. That's why I find it strange that I keep doing it, because I also, most books with letters, I just go, no, 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 just tell me the story. Don't give me the letters. So I don't know why I keep doing it. But
it works beautifully. You mentioned before the Dictionary of Colours. I wanted to ask you, because there's so many to keep track of, and like, as you're reading the book, you get familiar with the names of them. You know, the lemon yellow is deadly, and like, there's jangling violet, and clay brown, and like, you know, you start to become familiar with them. And I just wondered how much went into planning those, and it's great to know that you have a whole list, like, with everything that they do. And also Samuel's like little quirky speech patterns. I wondered if you kept a record of all of those little, as like an earplug in a catapult and all that sort of.
I did think about I should write that down, but then I thought the thing I like about Samuel is that everything, because I never planned what he was going to say. I really liked writing his character because it just came out of nowhere. I didn't have to think of it myself, so I didn't want there to be a dictionary of his expressions, because I wanted them to almost, I think his language is, part of the idea of it is that you can invent it every single time. And that's part of how you speak that language, is every simile you use has to be unrelated to what you are trying to describe. So
yeah,
that's, yeah, the
and
comparison.
It confounds people.
Exactly.
Some of them were just amazing. I wanted to start keeping a list at some point. Like, there was, you know, oh, I can't even remember, like a sausage in a windmill. And like, that's that just that kind of brand of absurd hilarity that just goes through the whole book, I really enjoyed. And the other thing I wanted to ask, which is a question that is asked between characters in the books, is that are you a person, when you read, who uses a bookmark, or do you turn down the corner of the page, or do you turn the book down flat with the pages open? Because I thought it was a great question.
Good, thank you. And I should be prepared with an answer to it if I put it in a book. I think I do all of those things. I don't like to put it down flat, because then it can damage the book binding.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing I don't do. And I don't like doing too much turning. Every time I turn a corner of a page down, I feel like I'm damaging the book too. But I might do that sometimes. So it's more using a random. I've got bookmarks and I always lose them. So it's always using some random object, even just turning over if I leave it on the bed, just putting a part of the pillow in the page that I'm up to. Or somebody gave me for Christmas a bookmark, which is a dictionary as well. Have you ever seen those?
No.
So it's a kind of little solid thing that, it's like a bookmark, but you can type in words that you need to. At first I got, when they gave it to me, I thought, you're suggesting I don't know words, that I need to look things up. But in fact, it's actually really good, because of course there are words that you come across that you might want to check on the meaning
cool.
of, so it's good. So.
No, I'm kind of the same. I'm a random object user.
Okay.
I used a spoon the other day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited to hear that you'll be writing more book-filled Ashery.
Okay.
And I really hope you return to cello, like, one day.
I do too. Thank you. I'm glad you say that. Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for your lovely questions.
And everyone, A Tangle of Gold, and not just A Tangle of Gold, but the whole Colours in Madeline series is available from Booktopia now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.